Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Black Friday, Cyber Monday, it's the season of feeling pressure to buy for ourselves, for others, or just because it's such a good deal. But the costs associated with our purchases are far greater than what we'll see on our credit card statements. Today, we talk about consumerism, how we can become more thoughtful consumers, and what is at stake if we don't slow our collective rate of consumption. Joining us is journalist and author James McKinnon. His latest book is The Day the World Stops Shopping, How Ending Consumerism Saves the Environment and Ourselves. James, welcome back to the program.
Thanks so much. Good to be back.
We tried to present this program last Tuesday, but we had major technical problems, so that prompted us to reschedule. So thanks for being flexible. The amount that we consume has increased significantly over the past few decades. Give us a sense of how much we consume and why it's a real concern.
Well, I mean, I think the real trend with consumption is that it's just always rising, and that it rises incredible amounts. I mean, since the 1960s, 1970s, the population of the United States has increased by about 60%, and consumption has increased by about 400%. So per person, we're consuming a whole lot more than we were a few decades ago. And that's been declared the greatest driver of the world's environmental problems by a UN panel that studies the use of global natural resources. So from climate change to deforestation to toxic pollution to species extinction, consumption is now an even bigger driver of environmental crises than the growth of the world's population.
And what we consume has changed a lot too. An example you give in the book to illustrate how consumption has grown is pet ownership. And it's a huge industry.
It is. I think it's about $16 billion a year in the US alone. And so, of course, we remember that in the past, we kept pets for specific purposes. Dogs might be used for hunting, cats might be used for keeping mice out of the barn. Now pets have their own consumer goods, beds, jackets, even digital products. And at this point, pets are contributing a lot even to the production of garbage and waste.
Humans haven't always been consumers. So describe when and why humans started down this path of becoming consumers.
Sure. I mean, historians and anthropologists and archaeologists have been looking back, trying to find a specific point in time when we became consumers in the way that we are today. And they really haven't been able to find a clear dividing point, because even in the earliest human societies, people might, for example, make a hand axe, but then decorate it in a special way to mark it as theirs personally. So the impulses that have made us consumers are very, very old, but consumption itself has really accelerated since the end of World War II. And the reasons for that were a few different things. One is that for a long period from the 1930s through to the end of the war, people lived in a period of austerity. They didn't have a lot of access to consumer goods and a consumer lifestyle because of the Depression and the wars. And during that time, we really learned a lot about how to produce lots and lots of consumer goods really cheaply. So from the 1950s on, that was the path that we started down, and consumption has just skyrocketed in the decades since.
How does the consumerism of the developed nations like the US, Canada, and Europe compare with developing nations?
It's dramatically different. So if we look at the consumption of a child, if we have a child in a wealthy nation like Canada or the United States or Western Europe, then that child is going to consume 13 times as much as a child raised in one of the world's poorer nations. If you have two children in a wealthy country, it's like having 26 children in one of the poorer countries. So there is an enormous gap in consumption between the wealthiest and the poorest nations of the world.
What do you think contributes to this huge difference? This isn't a minor, this is a really big difference.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of course, is simply wealth. As nations grow richer, then their citizens tend to consume more. That's part of the reason that it's really important that wealthy nations start to reconsider their consumption, because the world is moving in the direction that that we are at the moment. And in fact, our own consumption continues to increase. So we really do still have to think about this as something, well, you know, can the whole world live with the consumer lifestyle that the average American does, or that the average Western European does? And I mean, in terms of natural resources, the answer right now is certainly no. I mean, if everyone on Earth consumed in the way that the average American does right now, we'd need five planet Earths worth of resources to supply that lifestyle.
Wow. Talk about how the events of 9/11 impacted our views and behavior around buying goods.
Sure. Well, after the 9/11 attacks, George W. Bush famously suggested that the country go shopping as a way to recover from the attacks. And up to that point, I think a lot of people talked materialism and consumerism as maybe being problems, you know, either environmental problems or even problems that affected our spiritual life or our psychology. But when George W. Bush, you know, responded to a national crisis by suggesting that people go shopping, a lot of people were shocked by that. But at the same time, he wasn't really wrong. It was really necessary that people get back to the malls in order to rebuild the American economy. Really, what George W. Bush showed us was that we've created an economy now that is completely dependent on not only on our consumerism, but on our consumption growing more and more every year. And since then, world leaders have been much more open about that. Whenever there is a crisis, including during the pandemic, world leaders spoke openly of the fact that we need to get shopping in order to rebuild the economy. So at this point, it really is true to say that our primary role, our primary social role, is as consumers. Mm.
And just speaking of the pandemic, we've made it easy, right? You don't even have to leave your house to go shopping anymore. Food, clothes, you can get anything.
Yeah, I mean, the consumption was moving in that direction already, but the pandemic really accelerated the shift to consumption online. And yeah, as you say, everything can come to your door now.
Yeah. The title of your book is The Day the World Stops Shopping. And the premise of the book is to explore how that plays out in economies, human behavior, and environmental impact, which is to a large extent what happened in March of 2020 when the pandemic hit. And I asked you this the last time we were on, but I don't know if people heard the answer because of our technical problems. When did you conceive of this idea? It was pre-pandemic, right?
Yeah, no, I was almost finished writing the book when the pandemic struck, actually. So it was this really incredible opportunity to see the ideas that I was working out in the book play out in real life. So the book's a thought experiment. It imagines what would happen if the world stopped shopping. And I define that in the book as a sudden drop in consumer spending by 25% worldwide. And that's essentially what happened in a lot of countries when the pandemic struck in those first weeks and months.
Even before the COVID pandemic, the theory was that if we stop shopping or even drastically reduce our consumption, the economy will shrink. And a shrinking economy means stock markets fall. We'll see high rates of unemployment. The supply chain breaks down, ultimately resulting in widespread chaos. While the markets didn't fall during the pandemic, we did see widespread unemployment and a breakdown in the supply chain, which we're still feeling. So before we talk more about the economic and environmental impacts of reducing consumers, address that difference between planned slowing of economic growth versus the impacts of a global crisis on the economy.
I think a lot of people think that it's impossible to slow down consumption because the only times that we experience it are during recessions, wars, pandemics, and these sorts of things. And in those sorts of crises, because we see our society as a consumer society, we don't generally reorient society towards lower consumption. We try to stimulate consumption again, or we just sit tight and kind of wait for people to be ready to consume again if there's a loss of consumer confidence. The alternative is a planned and organized slowdown in the consumer economy. And so I sat down with a Canadian economist who's built a really elaborate model of the Canadian economy in his computer, and we dropped a sudden, shocking slowdown in consumption into his computer model. And what we found was that if that slowdown was too deep, then it really was difficult to control the economic consequences. But if it was gradual, then steps could be taken to maintain a stable society while reducing consumption.
And this is economist Peter Victor you're talking about, and you even have a name for the slow shopping, right? Is what we're calling it.
That's right. Yeah.
I'm just thinking too the psychology of what's happening when we have something like a pandemic or 9/11 and people stop shopping, and there's this uncertainty about the future. People get worried, right? They're like, oh, I better hold on to my money. But that's a little bit different. People would react a little bit differently if it is planned, right? I mean, then it's not this panic feeling of, oh my God, what's going to happen?
Yeah, like if you imagine a 1% reduction in consumption, I mean, that's considered something that's really undesirable by our current economists. But if it were planned and organized, then it's manageable. And I think a really important point is that most people wouldn't even notice. I mean, most people would hardly notice a 1% or even a 5% decrease in consumption because we were over-consuming to such a degree that we're filling our closets, for example, with clothes that we never wear. So they say that people are throwing out. If you buy, say, 10 garments, there are 5 of those that might never get worn or would be worn very briefly and disposed of. So you could cut your, if that's the situation for you, then you could cut down your clothing purchases by 50% and you'd still be left only with the clothes that you're actually going to keep and wear.
How would a slow market economy impact unemployment and poverty?
One of the things that's really clear is that if you have a slower churning or a gradually shrinking economy in terms of consumption, you have to pay a lot more attention to making sure that the jobs and the work that is available are spread more, the opportunities are spread as fairly as possible, and also that the wealth produced by the economy is distributed more fairly than it is today. So, it becomes even more important that you focus on some kind of equality of opportunity to access work and to access the wealth generated by the economy. That's absolutely true.
Would a slow market remove the incentives for innovation and investment?
It doesn't seem as though it would. I looked at research into innovation, and it indicates that innovation proceeds regardless of whether or not there is profit motive. In fact, in many, many of the innovations that are spinning out of our culture today originate with people who are not pursuing profit in the least, who are just trying to improve the capabilities of their specific profession. So there's above and beyond that, recreating a society so that it's functioning with lower consumption requires a lot of innovation. So there would probably be a real surge of innovation as people reoriented the economy, for example, away from cheap and disposable products and towards durable and longer lasting ones, or towards sharing models for consumer goods, as opposed to every individual household having to, own all of the possible consumer goods. So there'd be a lot of innovation involved in this kind of transition.
And you're talking about that 1-5%. Would we see meaningful reductions in CO2 emissions in a slow market economy?
Yeah, I think what I'm suggesting is that you can move incrementally towards cuts. So you might start with 1%, but you might eventually get to a place where you have reduced consumption by, for example, 25%. But even 1% would be dramatic. So one thing that's very clear is that when we slow consumption, carbon emissions, for example, will drop in the early days of the pandemic, there was the sharpest and deepest drop in carbon emissions ever recorded. And in fact, it's still the case today that despite all of our efforts with renewable energy and energy efficiency and decarbonization of the economy in general, the only times that we've seen absolute reductions in global carbon emissions have come during slowdowns in consumption. That's still the case today.
You know, it was shocking, wasn't it? When we saw the how much reduction we saw, which I think gives people a lot of hope when we're looking at the issue of climate change going forward, that it can be done.
Yeah, it can be done, but it's bound up in this dilemma that we all witness, I suppose, that the planet really seems to need us to slow down our consumption, and the economy seems to need us to consume more and more and more. So it seems to me that the answer here lies somewhere in changing the economy itself. Mm-hmm. So taking concrete steps to recreate the economy in such a way that that we consume less. Mm-hmm. And through that, we generate far fewer carbon emissions.
We're talking about consumerism this hour. If you have a comment or idea on how we can become more thoughtful and deliberate about what we buy for ourselves and others, you can join the conversation at 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about consumerism this hour. With us is journalist and author James McKinnon. His latest book is The Day the World Stops Shopping, How Ending Consumerism Saves the Environment and Ourselves. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. What did we learn from the pandemic about our priorities when it came to what we could live with, without, and what we actually needed?
That was a really interesting aspect of the pandemic because, well, certainly of those earliest weeks and months when people were locked out of consumer culture. And I relate this to the work I was doing at the time. So I was at that time, I was talking to a psychologist named Tim Kasser. He's one of the, perhaps the leading psychologist in the research of materialism. And we were talking about how the current value set that drives consumer culture is what psychologists call an extrinsic value set. So it operates around values that need external approval for them to be meaningful to us. Being fashionable is an example of a extrinsic value. You can think you're fashionable, but you aren't really fashionable in society unless other people agree with you, and that you need that external approval. There's this other set of values, intrinsic values, which are inherently satisfying. So these would be things like having a close-knit group of friends. Again, you might be admired for having a close-knit group of friends, but you don't need that external approval for it to be satisfying. And so our society mainly is centered on extrinsic values. I was asking Tim Kasser, how quickly would we turn to this other set of values, intrinsic values, if we turned our backs on consumer culture? And he said he didn't know because the research hadn't really been done on that. We had that conversation on January 30th, 2020. And later that day, the World Health Organization announced the coronavirus as a world health emergency. And very quickly, we saw people, once they were locked out of consumer culture, make this turn towards investing more of their time in intrinsically satisfying activities. So you'll remember the media reporting this epidemic of kindness and people reaching out to friends and family they hadn't spoken to for a long time, baking sourdough loaves famously. I mean, learning new skills and mastering new skills is an intrinsically satisfying value. Spending time in nature. And there were all these people, you know, locked in their homes, bird watching, you know, mm-hmm. all of these kinds of trends that indicated this shift towards this different value set. So we saw that people can make that turn very, very quickly.
Yeah. And I think some people will remain, right? I mean, when you talk about the fashion, I mean, everybody got used to being comfortable working on
That's
Zoom
right.
and not
That's
having
right.
to not having to be the fashionista, right?
Yeah. Yeah. That kind of need for, or that external pressure to, you know, to to show ourselves, in terms of fashion or show the world our possessions, it kind of vanished for a while, and people felt a really great deal of relief from that.
Another concept that's interesting is when you stop buying things, is you begin with this concept of time. What prompted you to even consider that time might be impacted?
Well, because in the broadest sense, if people are consuming less, then the economy needs to produce less, and so presumably that means everybody's working a little bit less. And so then this question of, well, one of the big things that we stand to gain from a lower consuming or a slower churning economy is a greater abundance of time. And certainly one of the modern crises, in a sense, is this feeling of time famine that a lot of people have, that they just don't have time to slow down, enjoy the simpler pleasures of life. And so we've seen in the past that people did feel they had a little bit more of that kind of time. Particularly, I looked back to the days of the Sunday Sabbath, which mm-hmm. are not that long ago, but there was one day a week when most people didn't have to work and really couldn't go out and consume. So one day a week with this big block of time to use in a different way. And if you look at people who practice voluntary simplicity, which is the pursuit of a simpler life, one of the things you notice about them is that they have a lot more time, and they do in fact invest it in these sorts of things, like building stronger relationships with the people they care about, or engaging with issues larger than themselves, like social justice movements or the environmental movement, spending a lot of time in the natural world. And it's not like they don't do any of the other things that people do, but they also have time to do some of these simpler, quieter kinds of activities.
Let's talk to Janet, who's giving us a call from West Tisbury. Good morning, Janet.
Good morning. I just came in from the barn, and I was about to tell you about a book, and lo and behold, you're interviewing the author. I picked it up at the West Tisbury Library. They're a very good library, and they're up to date on everything. And one of the things I liked were those sayings in the first part of the book, one of them by Mahatma Gandhi: Earth provides enough to satisfy every man's need, but not every man's greed. Mm. And that's so true today.
Yeah. Janet, thank you, and thanks for calling. Always appreciate that. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Another reason we buy more is because items break or wear out. That saying, they don't make it like they used to, is so true, right?
It's so true.
Many of the items we buy today, but whether it's clothing, a light bulb, or an appliance, they're designed to wear out, right? So tell us a little bit more about planned obsolescence.
Sure. Planned obsolescence is the deliberate design of a product so that it breaks down or falls out of fashion more quickly than it needs to. And it's been around since the early 1900s, since the early 1900s. And of course, it really defines the economy today. So there's been this steady drive towards cheaper but more disposable items and away from durable, long-lasting ones. And this is something that something I've noticed in taking this book out into the world, is that this is an issue that bothers people across the political spectrum mm-hmm. from all walks of life. I mean, there doesn't seem to be anyone who's really and truly satisfied with the idea that the products they buy today are junk. And so there's a real opportunity here, I think, to talk about how we can shift back towards an economy of quality rather than quantity. And we're starting to see some companies, especially sort of smaller businesses, moving in this direction and offering longer lasting products in markets where everything has shifted towards a more disposable type approach. And clothing is a really obvious one. So you've got some companies like Patagonia and Levi's recently joined this group, Eileen Fisher, another clothing maker, and a number of others, lots of small ones, where people are trying to make not only clothing that's durable in a physical sense, but clothing that can survive through a few fashion cycles without falling out of fashion. So choosing colors that are less likely to mm-hmm. you know, change with the fashion cycle overnight. But you also see it even in things like, you know, skis and snowboards and things like that, that like even things like that, even things like mountain bikes are now on a much higher replacement rate than they used to be in the past. Yeah. I mean, you used to be able to buy bicycles and you buy a bike and you might be riding it 50 years later. That's generally not the case with the bicycles that people buy today.
Yeah. Richard says, are there differences in consumption by different generations? Can we educate future generations about this?
Well, I mean, each generation, I think, has tended to have a group within it that has questioned consumerism, and then most of the generation ultimately following the path of consumerism. So, I mean, there are distinct differences, but overall, I would say that it generally the path is more from younger to older, and as people. When people are younger, there's often a period where they question consumerism or challenge consumerism, and then sort of really just fold into consumer society. Although it's also often the case that as people get older, they slow their consumption and reconsider it. Yeah. But a pretty exciting thing right now, I think, is that we do see in Generation Z this real push towards things like buying thrift store clothing. And really, I was speaking to a student journalist in New Jersey just yesterday, and she was saying, their generation is getting pushed so hard to consume more and more, particularly clothing. At the same time, they're seeing more and more the effects of climate change and other environmental problems, and they're really disillusioned with the idea that we can green all of the impacts of our consumption away through things like renewables and recycling and organics and things like that, because they just don't see that translating into real benefits for the environment and the planet.
We talked about they don't make things like they used to. One place you can find things, the thrift shops, right? I mean, when you have these younger people going for clothes, they're going to get a better product at a much better price, right? That will last a long time in the thrift shops rather than in some of the stores. Research shows that having more money, more possessions, doesn't make us happier. Can you elaborate on that?
Sure. I mean, if you go back, like American consumption has jumped something like a quarter, like 25% increase in the past 15 or so years. So are Americans 25% happier? Do they have 25% higher quality of life? I don't think very many people would say that they do. So at this point, in the wealthiest nations of the world in particular, we're adding a lot of consumption without adding much to our quality of life and certainly to our happiness. That, it's a terrible trade-off in terms of the consequences of our consumption being so minimal for us in terms of life satisfaction, but so serious in terms of consequences for the planet and even for the people of the planet.
What can we learn from cultures who assess an individual's status and worth through other measurements?
Well, we can learn a lot. I mean, I think if we look at older hunter-gatherer cultures, for example, I visited a culture in Namibia in the Kalahari Desert where they have 150,000 years of continuous culture in the same place, and they have never adopted the approach of income, possessions, and social status being at the core of their culture. And they are still able to express themselves strongly in terms of their identity as individuals. They value sharing above anything else, really. I mean, sharing is really the heart and soul of their culture, so much so that it's not quite as gentle and idealistic as it sounds. I mean, they have something that anthropologists call demand sharing, where if somebody begins to acquire an abundance of any wealth, basically, then the community can come and say, you have a responsibility to share that with the rest of us. So there are one thing that you learn from human cultural history is that there's a very wide range of approaches to consumerism. There is nothing hardwired in us that guarantees that this is the way we're going to live.
How did researching and writing the book impact your own buying?
It had two results. One was that I actually ended up probably buying a little bit more than I had in a long time, because I think, like a lot of people, I had become kind of paralyzed around what to buy. You know, it's just, you know, I'm concerned about environmental issues. I'm an environmental journalist, and I just started to feel like there was nothing I could do. But then I realized that there is this approach of buying fewer things, but higher quality things, and applying that even to services or to consumer experiences like travel, doing less, but trying to get more out of the things that I do. And so my consumption has moved in that direction. The other thing, though, is that it's really made me realize that it doesn't make sense to just see this as what can I give up? It's really important to look at what you can gain. And I've been switching to investing more of my time in this area of these intrinsically satisfying values, building stronger relationships I care about, for example, or making sure that I'm spending the time in nature that I know I find satisfying. And in that way, it doesn't feel like I'm losing things all the time. It feels like I'm actually getting a better quality of life.
Yeah. We're talking about consumerism. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about consumerism this hour. With us is James McKinnon. His latest book is The Day the World Stops Shopping, How Ending Consumerism Saves the Environment and Ourselves. Joining us now is also Jess Georgia. She's the founder and owner of Green Road Refill. Jess, welcome.
Hi, thank you so much.
So tell us about Green Road Refill and why you opened this business.
Sure. I founded Green Road Refill in May of 2018 out of a concern for the health of our planet. Basically, our major mission is to reduce Cape Cod's plastic footprint. So plastic waste is a huge issue. I know we've been talking about consumerism, but it's not only the stuff we buy, but what is it wrapped in? Why do we need to basically is the major thought with our product. So we refill over 40 plant-based products from home and body cleaners, shampoos, lotions, and then we also sell a lot of low to zero waste goods for your home and your body. And we've been a mobile business. I started with a gutted school bus named Betty, and I took her around to farmers markets and festivals, but with COVID and social distancing and a couple breakdowns, we switched over to Sally Sud Shed, and she's basically like a little she shed on wheels that I do the same. We do farmers markets from Falmouth all the way to Orleans, and just really encouraging people to make conscious consumer choices to reduce the waste in their life and to also be aware of what they're putting on their bodies, down their drains. You know, Cape Cod's aquifer is very fragile. So it's not just a store. I am selling things, but I'm also trying to, educate in a way that's not, I'm not perfect. You're going to find plastic in my house. Mm-hmm. But I'm just encouraging everybody to do a little. And when that little bit that you're making a change, whether it's switching over to a bamboo toothbrush or doing the refill, when it feels easy, then it's time to take the next step. And as a community, my hope is that, it will add up to make a difference in the health of the planet.
Now, we can't completely stop buying things, but you encourage people to consider the lifespan of the item we're buying. So explain what you mean by the lifespan.
Well, we were just talking with James about, the shelf life. We're in this kind of a society of convenience over sustainability. So what's going to happen to that gift, the hostess gift, the Christmas gift, after it's done? Is it going to an incinerator? Is it going into a landfill? Will it be shoved in a drawer? And, you know, so trying to think about the lifespan of the product. You know, unfortunately, we've been trained to think that recycling is the answer for everything. And unfortunately, that it is not the solution. So really thinking about quality over quantity, and why are we buying it? As far as it, is it making us feel good? Is it, you know, we've been trained to think that more is better. So I'm really trying to normalize not only, you know, sustainable goods, but also secondhand, handmade, consumable, and gifting experiences as well, and making, normalizing that kind of gift giving.
Yeah. Let's talk to Earl, who's giving us a call from Brewster. Hi, Earl.
Hi, Mindy. I wanted to talk about forced buying. My mother moved into her home in 1943. 60 years later, she moved out. The phone was still working. I'd hate to tell you how many phones I've had in the last 10 years.
Right.
Also, for decades, repairmen on cars didn't need parts. They just made adjustments, clean it out. But that stopped because now you need many parts.
Yeah.
And the cars don't last as long.
Yeah.
That's the end of my comments.
Yeah, Earl, thanks. And you know what, Earl, you bring up a really good point. I'm like that, you know, we all have the cell phones now, right? But you don't know how long I kept that landline.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And when the storms and stuff, my landline was still working, but I, you know, we ended up getting, but I thought, why do I have to keep buying a new phone? You know, and these phones are expensive, right? And it's to stop the support. I mean, it goes back to that, James, what you're talking about earlier, obsolescence, right? It's, they're meant to only have a lifespan of, you know, whatever it is, and then you have to buy the next newest and greatest and with lots of bells and whistles that maybe you don't even need.
Right? Yeah, and there's actually a challenge to that, but it's only available in Europe. It's called the Fairphone, and it's a modular phone so that you can replace the parts really easily in it. I sat down with Fairphone people, and they, you know, they were able to replace, I think it was the headphone jack, and it took the guy less than a minute. He just slid the screen off, popped the thing open, pulled out the jack, popped another one in, done. You know,
wow.
You with that, and they will update the software as well for much longer than the typical company. So there are, you know, there are these solutions out there, and they're just you know, they're certainly just the undercurrent of our society, but they could become, you know, they could take a central role eventually.
James, in the book, you describe giving a magic wand to the maker of sustainable dress shirts, and the wand would enable her to make one change that would result in an economy of better for less. What was her response?
Her response was that we need to build the price of the environmental cost and the social cost of products into the price of those products. So this is sometimes called true cost pricing, where, you know, if the production of your product pollutes water or emits carbon, then we tax some kind of price onto that that has to be built into the price of your product. And it would really shift things away from disposable and towards durable. It would really shift our economy away from the constant purchase of new products and more towards things like sharing models for products or simply buying less.
Yeah. So Jess, how can we as consumers think about the true costs of what we buy?
Well, I think, you know, going back to the afterlife, but also coming up with alternatives to, I'm just talking about going into the holiday season and gift giving. There's a couple really cool resources out there. One is the So Kind Registry, and it's kind of like a wedding registry, but it's more for, well, there's different purposes, but let's just say a family could create one. And rather than giving tangible gifts, giving experiences, their whole motto is more fun, less waste, mm-hmm. less stuff. And, you know, you can choose to ask for a museum membership or taking care of your dog or guitar lessons. So
yeah.
The idea of giving experiences.
I love that idea, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a friend she's got grandchildren, and she said, I don't want to buy these grandchildren any more toys. They have a million toys.
Yeah.
And so her idea was a family experience, you
mm-hmm.
know, like, you know, the a Bruins game, the Boston Ballet, you know, something that the family can enjoy. Which, I might add, if you are a family with several small children, you can't afford
tickets. Yeah, and I mean, the second hand also, there are a lot of thrift shops with toys, and, you know, most toys are made out of plastic, so let's give them a second life.
Yeah. So we talk about giving something used or regifting, and it's often viewed as less generous, even if we know that item will be used and appreciated by the recipient. Either of you have thoughts as to why we're so hesitant to admit that we are regifting?
I think a lot of it is that gift giving is bound up in these values. It's bound up in these kind of materialist consumeristic values, where in a sense, when we're giving gifts, we're showing off to a certain extent. I heard a really interesting thing, which is that in Finland, apparently, it's quite common to not label gifts. So they don't label who's giving the gift to the person. And apparently it just changes the whole psychology of it, because it doesn't become this kind of performance of, like, how much do I care about this person? Well, you know, I'll indicate that through the price of the gift, or how obviously valuable the gift is, or whether it's new or used. It just changes the whole psychology of it to, you know, who cares? Mm-hmm. People are showing, you know, the people I know are giving me gifts. I don't know which one's which.
Yeah.
it's a really great idea.
That is a great idea. And just, I know you're very supportive of local businesses, and we know the perfect gift that we need to buy, the best option is to support local craftspeople and businesses. We've got so many great craftspeople here. They don't have to have the merchant put it in a bag, right? It can, you can bring your own bag.
Oh yeah, there's so many ways to reduce the waste. As now I'm a retailer, so yeah, I have people donate their bags. They don't have to be pretty. There are so many great ways to also, you know, we're going into Christmas and wrapping paper and all that stuff. There's a whole art to wrapping with cloth. I'm going to butcher the name, but, you know, and just coming up with ways that we can give without that extra packaging, or put the effort into maybe making your own wrapping paper. We all have paper bags laying around. My daughter and I, we got some sponges and, you know, made some shapes and decorated our own paper. Yeah. And it makes it, that becomes part of the gift, right? It's the time and the effort. And I think that's really what the whole gift giving season is about, is showing, not just ordering something online. It's so automatic. It's so easy. And I'm not, you know, perfect. I do, you know, order things online too, but to put that extra effort in, it shows the love and the care.
Yeah. Let's talk to Renate, who's calling from North Falmouth. Good morning.
Yes. Good morning. I just wanted to add one little thing. My comment is about Amazon and how much I hate Amazon and the true cost of shipping and all the packaging material and all the additional traffic that is caused by Amazon. I like the idea what Maine just introduced, that actually the companies that ship the products have to cover the cost of the recycling of all the packaging materials. Mm-hmm. I feel that that America as a whole totally failed to prevent Amazon from being a monopoly. All the antitrust laws failed. I feel that it's a horrible idea. And I also hate the whole Prime membership idea. When my daughter was 18, she got a free Prime membership from her college, and I feel it's a very horrible marketing. I'm surprised that America allows, that they're allowed to market to teenagers. Yeah. And then hook them on the Prime membership, and then for the rest of their lives, they want them to be members. I think it's just so sad, because it takes away all the markups from the small businesses, and I'm a big fan of small, local products. So that's my 5 cents.
Yes, Renate, thanks for sharing. We appreciate your thoughts. James, what about the packaging? It's like, I'm just thinking back when I was a kid, things didn't come in all the, you know, the plastic and the, you know, it's there's so, and it's so hard to get into. I literally, if I have anything with packaging for Christmas for my grandson, I unpackage it all before, because I'm going to have to do it Christmas morning if I'm not doing it beforehand, right? And he'll want to play with it right away. Why do we have to have so much packaging?
I don't really know. I mean, I think a lot of it is in some cases there are health considerations, or the appearance of health considerations. It's a big mystery to me, actually. But one thing that's very clear is it's on the rise. I mean, getting, you know, there's more and more of it, and it's more and more sophisticated. And it's also one of these things where, you know, true cost pricing would really shift that game, because packaging is all cost and no value. And you know, it's if the price of packaging included its environmental consequences, which is pretty much 100% what packaging results in is environmental consequences, then I think there'd be an immediate push for lower packaging. Hmm.
James, your book suggests that slowing the economy can work. The question is, will we choose to do so? What do you hope people will keep in mind as they make choices about their personal consumption, and will even these modest changes be enough to make a difference long term?
Individual choices alone will not be enough. That's pretty clear from history. There's been a long series of kind of counter-consumer movements that never quite achieved the goal, but they really engage us with the idea that there is a problem with overconsumption. And so I do think individual choices are still important, but what they need to do is snowball into a push for changes in the system itself, so that we can all consume less. And we don't have to carry the weight of the world on our shoulders in that sense.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I just feel like one of the things I think we as consumers just need to wake up to is the pressure's been put on us to do the work, to do the recycling, that, you know, we're creating the waste. But it's time for us to make demands, whether it's through legislation, you know, to put the responsibility on the corporations. The Break Free from Plastic Pollution Act of 2021 is sitting in Congress. I urge you all to support it. Call your leaders. Luckily, Elizabeth Warren and Edward Markey are already on our side, but it's time to put that pressure on the corporations to make the changes in their packaging and their single-use throwaway culture that we've all kind of really succumbed to.
Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on that, James?
Yeah, I think succumb to is a great word for it, because there are all of these things that we did not demand. And we did not demand fast fashion. We did not demand this incredible increase in packaging. We don't, these are things that have been thrust upon us. One of the earlier callers referred to forced buying. And I think that's how a lot of people feel about it. So it's not that we're greedy and covetous, and that's what's driving consumerism. A lot of the time, it is just stuff that's thrust upon us. We embrace it, but we didn't ask for it. Mm-hmm. And so it's, you know, entirely reasonable for us to demand that change.
Just about a minute left, Jess. Mm-hmm. Thoughts that people, I mean, I know I really appreciate a gift that somebody's put a lot of thought into, mm-hmm. and I love the homemade gifts, or like you said, the wrapping paper that you've made yourself. Just a final thought for listeners.
Well, just I would say take a moment when you're holding something, whether it's at a thrift shop, hopefully, or a TJ Maxx, and just think about the afterlife and what is the value that, you know, is it the moment that they're going to open it? But if you can find a local store, a local maker, supporting keeping the money right here on the Cape is important. And that way it has a story behind it. It's not just a credit card number going into the website. And you know, you'll see a big smile when you can attach that story.
Jay McKinnon's latest book is The Day the World Stops Shopping, How Ending Consumerism Saves the Environment and Ourselves. Jess Georges is the founder and owner of Green Road Refill. We'll post links to James' books and the Green Road Refill at our website, capeandislands.org. Thank you so much, both of you, for joining us. Really an interesting conversation this morning.
It was my pleasure.
Appreciate that.
Pleasure. Thanks so much.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.